About 150 years ago, brave settlers from the east packed their wagons, refreshed their horses, fled from vicious creditors, and headed out west. There, these settlers would find opportunities, new lives, gold, steady jobs, a dependable stock of exploited prostitutes, and unfulfilled dreams often glossed over by the heroic Technicolor Westerns that followed a mere century later. An early ancestor of Bat Segundo would gradually shift away from safe sarsaparilla and discover the addictive qualities of whiskey and other forms of lovely liquor, spawning a long family line of wastrels and slackers who never quite fulfilled their potential. But not all of these intrepid explorers would make the entire 3,000-mile journey, for between both poles of the United States resides a great expanse known only as the Midwest. This part of the country remains frequently misunderstood, often mocked by self-absorbed people who, despite the advent of Copernican theory, somehow believe that Manhattan is the center of the universe. But is the Midwest just a collection of red states, or is there something more to it? Fortunately, the Lit Blog Co-op, and fiction as a result, found an answer with the heroic Dan Wickett, who selected a book that dealt with this very question.
So I am here once again with the fantastic and seemingly indefatigable Dan Wickett, who has nominated Kelly Wells's Skin. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you, Ed. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. Now, I have to ask you, what was it about Skin that made this an LBC nominee?
Well, I suppose it goes back to once I was asked to join the LBC, I had made a promise to myself that if any book could ever intertwine both George Brett and Prairie Dogs into one novel, I'd have to nominate it.
Gotcha.
Kelly happened to do both.
Were you attracted to the language in this book, which is particularly Baroque and ornate at times? Or?
Yeah, actually, I had read some of Kelly's work prior to this, her short story collection, Compression Scars, a couple years back, and was really struck by, I guess, the combination of some sort of religious curiosity and confusion, and combining that with just a big interest in biology. Mm-hmm. In the language itself, she's another author who has me sitting with a dictionary by my side as I read. There's quite a bit of interesting language and knowledge and words, I guess, that I was previously unfamiliar with as I was reading along through her work.
What is the character structure in this book? I get the sense that you're attracted to books with both, you know, interesting wordplay or language, as well as characters who are vibrant like the ones in this book.
Yeah, definitely. I always appreciate someone who can put together a novel or stories around interesting characters. Sorry about that, Ed. I'm getting an incoming call.
Oh, okay. Keep going.
Don't worry. It's just going to beep a few times. It's not a name I'm familiar with, so I'm not going to pick it up.
Okay.
But back to what I was saying. Sorry. Yeah, anytime a novelist or story writer can put together something coherent around quirky or interesting characters that I can actually grow to care about throughout my reading of their work, that's always a big plus with me.
Gotcha. All right, Dan. Well, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
I am here with Kelly Wells, author of the LBC nominee Skin. Kelly, how are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, hanging by. We have a leak here in the apartment, but craziness. It looks like there's craziness on both of our sides. Now, I wanted to first of all talk about this book as how it is actually classified. Would you classify this book as a novel or a novel in stories or a short story collection? Is this a short story collection where the stories happen to relate with one another? I know you have organized these things into chapters. Maybe you can talk about how you came to write Skin and how things kind of were set about from that based off of that.
Sure. I like to think of it as a novel myself, although this was something that was troubling to some of the editors who read the book when it was sent around, that it was neither fish nor fowl, that it wasn't easy to classify. I don't think of it as stories because the the stories don't they don't really stand alone. Some of them do. Some of the chapters might have a standalone quality about them, but they, to my way of thinking, they're interdependent. And so, but I thought, you know, there ought to be a lot of ways to write a novel. And while writing a novel that has a sort of conventional arc and that moves in a way that speaks to conventional expectations is a perfectly fine way to write a book, it wasn't the way that it occurred to me. And I was really interested in the community and sort of trying to represent a community consciousness. And I think that's what guided my choice to write it in this sort of fractured way where there isn't a single protagonist or a guiding through line, but it's more imagistically and linguistically driven, I would say.
Gotcha.
It started as a short story, which is the title story of my first collection, Compression Scars, and there were characters in that story who I thought ought to have their own say. For example, there's a character named Mr. Dorset who is a Baptist deacon, and I had this fear after I wrote that story that maybe I had given him short shrift, or I'd sort of cartooned him in a way that made me feel a little uncomfortable afterwards, and I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity to sort of let him have his say and to see what his story actually is, so it doesn't seem like I'm trying to burlesque Baptist deacons. Let's see. Were there other parts of your question I should be addressing?
Oh, no. I mean, I kind of wanted to get a sense of how you led from these short stories that were actually published, whether you had some sort of overarching plan, whether the novel format or the interconnected stories format sort of came as you were writing the stories. What came first, the chicken or the egg, that kind of thing?
Right. Well, as I said, the story Compression Scars was the launching pad for the novel, and it grew entirely out of that. Although there are characters in the novel who don't appear in that story, and because I wanted to, because I was as interested in the community as the individual, I wanted to try to write the book in a way that seemed to me to have something to say about community. So, to my way of thinking, these characters are sort of similarly metaphysically assailed. They share images. One character will sort of pass off an image to another character. And there's language that I think, even though, I hope that each character is distinct and stands alone and wouldn't be mistaken for another character, nevertheless, there are ways in which they're all similar, I think. And that was one of the challenges that I set up for myself, that I wanted to have this community consciousness, and yet I wanted to have characters who came across within that world, within those concerns, within that language, as particularized and individual and distinct. So the structure of the book rose out of that problem or that challenge that I had set for myself. And there are a couple of chapters at the beginning and at the end where there's an actual sort of omniscient community voice, a voice of the community that's not being filtered through a particular character, but sort of, you know, the voice of what's here, the town where the novel is set. And that was something else that I wanted to think about and work with and write, was a single voice that was going to stand in for all these various characters and the sorts of issues that they were all grappling with, similarly but distinctly. I hope, that was my hope.
Gotcha. Now, each of the stories is often narrated, or there is a character who is affixed, or several characters affixed to each particular story. Did you have difficulties trying to find distinct voices? Because the nature of your language is often very, very precise. In terms of like finding sort of, you know, distinct kind of voices and being an impressionist, maybe you can describe how you went about doing that for each particular character. Did you find the voices as you wrote the stories? Maybe you can describe and talk about this process.
Okay. The voices. Let's see. Well, there are lots of first-person voices, and I knew that this would be sort of the... This would be the thing for the book, the thing that the book had to grapple with, and the, you know, the criticism, one of the criticisms that the book would be vulnerable to would be that there would be a sort of sameness to the voices and to these people's concerns, and there is, and as I described before, it was intentional, it wasn't accidental, but I knew that it might, for some readers anyway, it might great on their nerves. So I did try to, within the commonality between the characters and the language, I did try to fashion particular voices. And I guess part of what I relied on to make them, to particularize them, was a sort of mixing of... I don't want to say homespun, that's sort of a horrible word, but, a sort of familiar Midwestern, particularly Kansas Midwestern vernacular, with a sort of heightened diction. That was the combination that was going to make it at least interesting for me, that there were going to be those two things operating in each character. And so hopefully... the Baptist deacon, Mr. Dorset, while there might be echoes of his voice in the character of Mrs. McCorkle, who's a character in her 70s who's a little delusional, but also is she delusional or does she have foresight? I mean, that's sort of the question for that character. But there are ways they sound similar, I'm sure, but hopefully that you would read a chapter from the point of view of Mrs. McCorkle and you would immediately identify it as Mrs. McCorkle and you wouldn't mistake it for the character of Mr. Dorset. And so even though with both of those characters, I mean, I'm working with a kind of familiar Midwestern idiom, and likewise I'm also working with heightening their voices in different ways. Nevertheless, it was my hope that within those voices there were distinctions, and for the other characters too. There are, I think, seven characters who are allowed to speak in the course of the novel.
It's not just also the vernacular. I would also argue that the details, the cultural details in this book, are also, I guess, for lack of a better word, I guess, rustic or Midwestern. But nevertheless, I identified them. I grew up in Sacramento in the 80s and the 90s, and so. For example, things like the Pop Cap Gun and Barnabas Collins and things like that. This is a bit different from what you generally see in literary fiction. And, it doesn't often dwell on this minutia. It's sort of, at least not in this sort of sincere manner. It's kind of reminiscent to some degree of Sherwood Anderson, but I wanted to, ask you, to what extent is Skin or your fiction sort of a chronicle of this kind of, culture that, largely remains, I think, unwritten about today? It's a very curious thing.
That's a really interesting observation. I mean, the one observation that gets made about my work a lot that is sometimes aggravating to me is that it's really consumed with popular culture, which I can't argue that that's the case. But your way of thinking about how I use that popular culture is much more interesting and thoughtful to me. To my way of thinking, Barnabas Collins doesn't get written about nearly enough in fiction. but it's true that there. I like the word chronicle. That there are these things that I experienced as a child and growing up. These things in the in the physical material world around me, and in particular in Kansas where I grew up, they aren't worked into my fiction casually. I I hope they're not. I mean, that they seem to me to have significance and have something to say about the culture that's meaningful. And I mean, I am concerned about sort of contextualizing certain things so that, you know, that the books won't have to be, you know, really heavily footnoted. Were they ever fortunate enough to be translated in another language, or should they last for 100 years? Though I suppose there would be a lot of footnotes. There was something else about your question that I wanted to address. So I like the idea that there's a certain sort of experience of the popular world that I'm trying to chronicle, and that hopefully has something meaningful to say about the experience of being in the world in, you know, the late 20th, early 21st century. But I'd like to hear you say more about how you think that's not happening enough in fiction, or what exactly you mean by that.
Well, you know, a lot of, I think, contemporary literature deals more with, if they do mention products or cultural sort of things, it's not necessarily, I guess, I don't know, to my mind, populist. I mean, you know, like something like, you know, TGNY or Woolworths, you know, something like that is both distinctly Midwestern and suburban. And yet I don't think we really get a sense of this, or even like, you know, I guess to the current answer would probably be one of those dollar stores, you know. But the thing is I don't feel that when contemporary fiction does deal with this, largely
seriously, pay no attention to this answer. I am interrupting my particular words here because what I don't realize is that the phone has died, and I am simply trying to respond to Miss Wells' very provocative question about what it is I'm talking about. Simultaneously, I have a little bit of a cold, and there's also a considerable leak that is actually happening in the bathroom as this conversation is going on. So I'm rambling, I'm unaware, and very soon you shall encounter the moment where I realize that Miss Wells is actually no longer connected. From this, we switch to a cell phone, but I do apologize.
Hello?
A beleza que existe.
Anyway, one of the houses said, I'm afraid there's no room in contemporary on the contemporary American literary landscape for a wet chair Kansas. So this was something that was held against the book, mm-hmm. that it was Midwestern, although I never thought of it as being I think of myself as being a Midwestern writer and being, you know, very heavily influenced by where I grew up, and I don't disavow it. I don't have any problems when people say about me that I'm a Midwestern writer, but there does seem to be a prejudice that exists anyway in New York publishing, but I never thought of myself as being, you know, a sort of stereotypically Midwestern writer, you know, a writer of heartland fictions. But so it's interesting that for you growing up in Sacramento, the details seem exotically Midwestern, particularly Midwestern, the popular culture aspect of it. And I'm trying to think of what some of those rustic, you mentioned some, and now I've forgotten what they were, but what some of those rustic, specifically Midwestern popular cultural things were. Could you tell me again?
Yeah, it was sort of like TGNY.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Things like this. I mean, you know, I guess I grew up in the South Bay and then Sacramento, so I saw a lot of this growing up. And, you know, oddly enough, I was sort of suggesting that it was because it wasn't just because urban versus suburban. It was also, I think, that if you are a cultural chronicler in fiction these days, it's generally like movies or books or, you know, pop stars, that kind of thing. But in this, the emphasis isn't so much on that. It's more on, you know, things like pop cap guns and the like.
Right.
You know,
okay.
I, you know, maybe we could sort of, you know, brainstorm on this.
necessarily find that particularly alienating, being something that was outside your experience.
I'm sorry?
Those things that you identified as being sort of specifically rural Midwestern, that those you didn't experience them as being sort of alienating because they were outside your experience?
No, they weren't alienating. I think what it is that in fiction, we don't necessarily see these particular details there. And it's instead, the emphasis is on, you know, Hugo Boss suits. Or, you know, Tom Cruise or the like, you know. I mean, you know, I guess you see it to some degree with, I guess, but at the same time, it's more like, you know, Skippy Peanut Butter with, like, Stephen King or someone like that. It's more, it's not so much the pop cap guns or the, you know, the kind of life that you know, people growing up in the 70s and the 80s sort of experienced, you know. And maybe we could sort of put our heads together and figure out why this is. What I was sort of also implying was that, you know, look, California isn't Midwestern. I mean, these are things that happen all across the United States, you know?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it is a really interesting point. I mean, it's something that I have thought a lot about in the past because it has come up as a criticism of my work that there's actually too much of this in it, and it might strike somebody as like, you know, product placement, which... Really, I don't mean it to be, but I remember when I was in school and I first started writing and first started showing my work to people and professors, and I remember that one of the things one of my professors said to me was that those sorts of details were really bad because they dated my work and they placed it too specifically, and that if I wanted it to be, you know, timeless, that I needed to sanitize it of those kinds of details. And this was sort of a kind of hair raising to me, this idea, because it ended up so paralyzing me to try to sit down and write something that I thought was going to be meaningful. I mean, obviously, I now understand it to be bad advice, but at the time, it seemed like, well, yes, of course, what you write should cut across time and space and cultures and whatever. If I mention a cap gun, then, you know, that's immediately going to set it in time and space in a way that might therefore be delimiting to the story or the book. And so it is something I've thought about and worried about, and maybe that's why... it's something that doesn't happen more often in fiction, is that there is this attempt to, there's this concern about things being sort of resonant across cultures, across time, in a way that if you mention something that at some point or for some group might necessitate a footnote, then you're automatically potentially limiting your audience. Maybe that's the thinking. I remember this sort of argument coming up for David Foster Wallace too, and he had, as he always does, some very snappy answer for it, and I'm trying to remember what it was, but I think it had something. He talked about, I think, like the British Romantic poets and Shakespeare, and said, you know, they also included what was popular in their day, but we don't perceive it to be popular culture anymore. We just consider it to be part of their culture, the sorts of things that they might have alluded to or been working with. And I thought that was a pretty interesting and persuasive defense.
Well, to look at, like, James Joyce's Dubliners, there are endless references to Guinness there. There are, you know, I remember reading an O. Henry story where I encountered Budweiser. And thinking to myself, wow, you know, well, this is very interesting. It's nothing really sort of changes. And not only that, but also, you know, there's something to be said for context. You know, people aren't going to, if you're going to, you know, I'm going to go to See's to pick up a box of chocolates. Well, you know, See's is a candy store. Or if you're really curious, you can, you know, look up See's, you know, maybe 50, 75 years down the line, if it still exists, if it doesn't exist, and find out what it was. I mean, you know, it's...
Right.
I've read, like, you know, newspaper items from the 30s, where I've found chain stores that I you know, that you can't find any trace of on the internet.
Right.
For example, Martha Washington's candy store was a huge 300 chain series of candy stores. There's no trace of it anywhere on the internet. But,
right.
You know, if anything, I'm more curious and more wanting to find out, well, what was this Martha Washington's place? Was it sort of like the See's Candy of its day or equivalent? So there's something to be said, I guess, though, for cultural context and also, you know, what we were talking about earlier, the word that you latched onto, which was chronicle. I mean, you know, what extent are you as a fiction writer sort of a chronicler, not just, you know, not just of culture, but also of human behavior? I mean, maybe behavior is kind of rooted in particular times, too.
Yeah, well, those are all extremely interesting observations. I mean, you're obviously a very intellectually curious person, and therefore that makes you a terrific reader, an ideal reader, somebody who's willing to not know things, but then has the curiosity to sniff them out if you don't know them, and you want more context and you want a better understanding of whatever detail it is that you didn't recognize. And that, I mean, it's interesting when you think there are some details that, you know, everybody would be expected to, if they didn't know them, to find out more about them. You'd be, you know, if somebody was writing about, I don't know, something historical, like Sacco and Vanzetti came up, and there was a reader who didn't know what was going on, and you would be expected to want to find out about that. But, well, this is a bad comparison, because I was about to compare Sacco and Vanzetti to Spirograph, which... probably.
Nothing wrong with batty associations here, Kelly.
But my point just is that, let's say that department store from the 30s, that's a much better example. There's something, I mean, there would be a kind of cachet about knowing that because it's historical or it's past or it's something that is illustrative of a moment that's behind us. And so if you knew that, or if you tracked it down, I think that would be, you know, considered just you were exercising your intellectual curiosity. But if you didn't know what a spirograph was, say, and you wanted to know about it and you found it out, that would just be trivia, I think. I mean, I think you wouldn't be perceived to be intellectually curious in the same way, maybe because... maybe because a spirograph is kind of a strangely goofy toy, but also because it's not of a moment that's far enough behind us for us to want to honor it as more as being suggestive of something in the culture and being and therefore being more than simply trivia. Yeah, I mean that's interesting. I'm liking thinking about this. You were asking too about my being a chronicler, or writers being a chronicler of human behavior?
Yeah, yeah, and the sort of adaptive nature of human behavior. I mean, you know, if you look, for example, at, like, you know, a Dickens or a Thackeray novel, you're going to see, you know, a more formal kind of human behavior that to sort of, like, you know, maybe a young reader today is going to be, you know, shocking in its formality, in its decorum.
Right.
Yet at the same time, it represents, you know, like, you know, look at the Pickwick Papers, for example. One of the pivotal sort of subplots, one of the hilarious subplots about it is this whole thing of Pickwick getting unintentionally engaged to this woman. And the thing, without actually having that knowledge of, like, okay, well, back during that time, if you made any kind of advance to a woman whatsoever, leading a woman to believe that you were engaged to her, then you could be taken to court. It's not actually explicitly stated because, you know, during the time Dickens was writing about it, well, people knew that this was the deal. But then, you know, when I first read Pickwick Papers, I was, around 19 or so, I had no idea of this law. And I had to look it up, and I was astonished to find that this was the norm, you know? So,
right.
So that is kind of one example of, like, how a past... pattern of behavior comes back and becomes an you know, invaluable reference point to how humans behave. And I guess,
right.
You know, to what extent are you kind of aware of this, you know, during the course of writing about, like, you know, Ansel Dorset being this kind of hard case evangelist who's has this whole septic tank situation going on.
Right. It's another very fruitful and interesting question, and what I want to be careful about, I think, is that I don't want to be essentializing about, you know, what constitutes Midwestern behavior in particular. What I'm thinking about is the abuse in the book. There's a character who ritually abuses his daughter, and I am of a class and place, and I live in a place where certain sorts of abuse, I witnessed them. I mean, it wasn't that uncommon. And having said that, I would say that hopefully I am making observations that are, well, sadly relevant to, you know, more than simply Kansas or Turner, Kansas, and that I've witnessed something that is sadly and unfortunately more pervasive. So in that way, that's what I mean when I say I want to be careful not to be essentializing when I talk about what it is I hope that I'm chronicling with regard to human behavior. But what interested me about that character and that particular form of abuse was the idea that in his mind, in this character's mind, his abuse had a purpose. He was hardening his daughter to the world for fear that, I mean, this was how he rationalized it to himself, for fear that that she might be too easy a mark for the world if she weren't to receive this lesson. And so, with that in mind, this ritual abuse takes place, which he, as he gets older, he later regrets. And that was something that, about human behavior and how horrific acts get rationalized, that was interesting to me to think about and to observe and to try to work through the naughty complexities of. Have I gone far afield from your original interest?
Oh, no, it ties into that, and feel free to digress. Digressions are welcome here.
Okay. Yeah, as you, I'm sure, could see, I sort of tell a story by way of digression.
Oh, yeah, well, of
course.
And I
don't do it to be aggravating. It's how it occurs to me.
We're talking about behavior that is different, or that is, you know, perhaps somewhat more shocking in a more kind of small town sort of setting, and that brings up the Zero and It storyline, which could also have been transposed into an urban setting to some degree,
right.
But at the same time, maybe you can talk about how this aspect of the book kind of made itself known, or at least why you dwelled upon this, which seemed a little bit different from the other stories.
Right, yeah, that's a good point to make, that this book is set in an imagined place. What cheer, Kansas doesn't really exist. There is a What Cheer, Iowa.
I did notice that, yeah.
But, and I like the name What Cheer because it sounds like what's here? And and so I transplanted it to Kansas. But where I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, in a part of Kansas City, Kansas called Turner. And it was this really sort of destabilizing place insofar as it had one foot in a rural life and one foot in an urban life. So if we drove for 20 minutes, we would end up in Kansas City, Missouri, which is a much more urban setting than Turner, Kansas. So I had this kind of bifurcated experience, and that was something else that I sort of wanted. I wanted to be able to be both rural and urban, in a sense, in the book. I wanted to represent this place that is at once both things, or a place where at least one would have access to both sorts of experiences. Because I think it's uniquely odd. I mean, having exposed to both of those things. I mean, living among and going to school with farmers and the children of farmers, that is, and then also, you know, not being very far from a very urban sort of downtown where you would, I mean, that's where the club where it does its performance is. It's in my mind, it's in this downtown Kansas City sort of place. And
sure.
And you know, I was a punk back in my day. And so I had those experiences. We would cross the state line, you know, and go over to Kansas City, Missouri to go to various sorts of clubs. So we could mosh. And then we would come home and we would have our more, you know, conservative rural experiences by day.
Well, we had a Sacramento punk scene too.
That sort of interstitial sort of thing is interesting to me. I mean, I'm very interested in, you know, writers who are immigrants, for example, and they have, you know, one foot in this culture and one foot in another culture. Those sorts of experiences are deeply interesting to me, that the way that one has to sort of split herself in order to meet the demands of two different sorts of cultures. And so I think of where I grew up as being sort of similar. I mean, obviously there are significant differences, but it's that same sort of thing that you have this kind of schizophrenic personality and experience as a result of exposure to both kinds of experiences. And that's, I guess, where Zero and Id sort of, that's the role, one of the roles that they're playing in the book.
Gotcha. We're going to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask you at least one last question, and that is, many of the stories in this collection, or the, you know, tales, or the interstitial tales, however we want to categorize it, it's open to reader interpretation. There is a kind of interesting sort of balance between kind of a magical realism. You have, like, for example, Ruby Loomis's fruit growing from her body, the cataclysm at the book's opening. You have Duncan's compression scars, a tree filled with bats. And yet, there's also, you know, as we've sort of discussed, this effort on your part to offer a faithful realism. The way that, you know, Ansel Dorset, for example, bothers everybody near the beginning. So, did you have any, you know, cardinal rules, if you pardon the St. Louis pun, to like, you know, determine which of these stories were magical realist or which were traditionally realist? Maybe you could describe the relationship you have between these two forms of realism.
Sure, I'll try to give you the abbreviated version. I mean, this is a big sort of subject for me. Strict realism, strict verisimilitude has never, it just has never interested me as a writer. As a reader it does, but as a writer it just hasn't served me well. I just haven't been able to do what I've wanted to do by being strictly mimetic. On the other hand, there are things about how people talk and their behaviors and the way that they live that would be familiar to most people and that do interest me. I do want to interrogate those things and work with them. So out of that was born this perhaps sometimes sense marriage between fantastical elements or fabulous elements and more realistic elements. I would say that that we did have bats in our tree when I was a child, so that actually is not one of the fabulous elements. But of course, I have a character who levitates and haven't had that experience. It's that meeting of the fantastical with the recognizable or the familiar that's the space that I'm most comfortable inhabiting, because I feel like I can ask the questions that I want to ask, and I can engage in a kind of I can engage in a kind of philosophical inquiry that, were I to be all one or the other, I think wouldn't come readily to me. It would be more difficult to do. And so, as I'm working on a new novel, and this novel is going perhaps in a more fully fabulous direction. And yet, it is still grounded, as this book is, I think, here and there in very, very mundane, recognizable details and behaviors and settings and so on. I'm very interested in the marriage between those two things, and you know, it gives me the freedom to use language. At least I feel that it gives me the freedom to use language in the way that I want to. That if I were doing wholly one or the other, I would be more straitjacketed. But in my mind, the way that I bring these things together enables me to do things with language that might otherwise call attention to the line. It's, I mean, I know it calls attention to itself now as it is, but it would call more attention to itself yet if I were purely a fabulist writer or purely a realist. And I think my work is in this gray area as a result that might, unfortunately, be equally alienating, you know, to both poles, or to either pole.
Sure.
So, you know, I've never been embraced by lovers of strict realism. And likewise, I mean, people who are writers who are on the far end of the experimental side of things, I think have a hard time being interested in my work. And this is just another way that the writing is neither fish nor fowl, and perhaps sort of unfortunately limits its audience in that way. But it's really the only way I feel like I can do what I'm trying to do. It's just what is organic to me.
Gotcha. Well, Kelly, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Time.